Are they not, then, out of their minds and mad, all who are eager to display untimely frankness of speech, sometimes daring to speak and act against kings and tyrants, not perceiving that they have been yoked, not only by the neck, as cattle are, but with their whole bodies and souls, and with wives and children and parents and the whole populous circle of kinship and companionship bound over as well? And that it is possible for the charioteer and rider, with perfect ease, to goad, to drive, to rein in, to check, to arrange matters small and great just as he wishes. And so, branded and scourged and mutilated, enduring all at once, savagely and pitilessly, every hardship that precedes death, they are led away, and in the end they die. These are the wages of untimely frankness of speech, not frankness at all, in the judgment of sound-minded jurors, but folly and derangement and incurable melancholy through and through. What are you saying? A man sees a storm at its height, a heavy wind blowing against him, a squall bursting forth, and a sea heaving with waves. When he ought to be putting into harbor, does he instead put out to sea and set sail? What pilot or shipowner was ever so drunk and so far gone in madness as to wish to sail through all the dangers I have named, so that the sea, poured in from above and swamping the vessel, might swallow it up together with its passengers? For the man who wishes to sail without danger, it was possible to wait for a calm, favorable, and gentle wind. What else? A man sees a bear or a wild boar or a lion advancing upon him with a rush, when he ought to calm and tame it. Does he instead provoke it to greater fury and stir it up, so as to make himself ready as a feast and banquet for merciless, raw-devouring beasts? Unless one is also to resist spiders and Egyptian asps, and all the other creatures whose destructive venom it profits no one to oppose, since they bring inescapable death upon those once bitten. For it is enough, by charming and taming them, to suffer nothing terrible from them. Are there not, then, some human beings more savage and more treacherous than boars, spiders, and asps, whose treachery and hostility it is impossible to escape except by employing tameness and conciliation? That is why the wise Abraham did obeisance to the sons of Heth, who are interpreted as those who stand outside themselves. Gen 23:7, since the circumstances of the time persuaded him to act so. For it was not out of honor for those who are, by nature, birth, and custom, the enemies of reason, who take the soul's coinage, education, and drive it out of its senses and pitifully squander it in small change, that he came to do obeisance, but because he feared their present power and their hard-to-conquer strength, and was on guard against provoking them, so that he might secure by service and by word, rather than by fighting and warring against them, a great and firm possession and prize of virtue. The finest dwelling place of wise souls, the double cave, which he could not obtain by combat, but could win by yielding and attending to them with reasoned speech. What else? Do we not ourselves, when we spend time in the marketplace, habitually step aside both for magistrates and for beasts of burden, but from opposite motives and not the same one, for magistrates out of honor, for beasts of burden out of fear that some harm might come to us from them? And when circumstances allow it, it is good to attack and put an end to the violence of enemies. But when they do not permit this, it is safe to remain quiet. And when we wish to derive some benefit from them, it is fitting to tame them. For this reason, it is worth praising, even now, those who do not yield to the champion of empty opinion, but resist him and say, "Will you indeed be king and reign over us?" Gen 37:8. For they see that he has not yet grown strong, not yet like a flame kindled and blazing, fed by abundant fuel, but still like a spark smoldering, dreaming of glory, not yet openly pursuing it. For they lay down good hopes for themselves, as though they might yet avoid being captured. They say beforehand, "Will you reign over us?" As if to say, "Do you imagine you will hold power while we are alive, existing, strong, and breathing? For should we grow weak, perhaps you will prevail, but while we remain vigorous, you will be ranked among the subjects." And this is the way things naturally are. Whenever right reason is strong in the mind, empty opinion is broken down, but it grows strong once reason has weakened. So then, as long as the soul still has its own power intact and no part of it has been mutilated, let it take courage to shoot and hurl its darts at the vanity opposing it, and let it speak freely, saying, "You shall not reign, nor shall you be Lord." Gen 37:8. Neither over us nor over any others besides us. But your threats and menaces we shall rout in a single charge, together with our bodyguards and shield bearers, the offspring of prudence, those of whom it is said that they added still more to their hatred of him because of his dreams and because of his words. Gen 37:8. But are not words and dreams merely the images that vanity fashions, while facts and clear, self-evident realities are all that bears upon a right life and right reason? The former, being falsehoods, deserve hatred. The latter, being full of lovable truth, deserve friendship. Let no one, then, still dare to accuse men of such virtue as displaying the character of haters of humanity and haters of their own kin. Rather, let him learn that it is not a human being who is now under judgment, but the mad lover of opinion and vanity, found among the dispositions in each person's soul, and let him approve of those who take up implacable enmity and irreconcilable hatred against it, and never let him embrace what they have detested, knowing with precision that such judges of the mind would never have erred from soundness, but having learned and been trained from the beginning to worship and honor the true King. The Lord, they grow indignant if anyone robs God of his honor and summons God's suppliants over to service of himself instead. For this reason they will say boldly, "Will you indeed reign as king over us?" Gen 37:8. Or do you not know that we are not self-governing, but are ruled by the immortal King, the one and only God? And again, "Will you indeed be Lord over us?" Gen 37:8. For are we not owned, and have we not had, and shall we not always have for all time, the very same Lord? Serving him, we rejoice as no one else rejoices in freedom, for to be a slave to God is the best of all things that are honored within creation. I too, then, would pray to be able to remain firmly steadfast in the things known by these men. For watchmen and scouts and overseers of deeds, not of bodies, they are, exact and just, sober through the whole of time, so as never to be deceived by any of the usual lures. But I myself am still drunk even now, and make use of much obscurity, and need staffs and guides like the blind. For one who leans on a support might perhaps manage neither to stumble nor to slip. But if some people, knowing themselves to be unexamined and unreflective, are not eager to follow with all exactness and care those who have examined all that must be examined, being ignorant of the road even though others know it, let them understand that, entangled in impassable pits, they will not be able to go forward even if they hasten. As for those men, whenever I am relieved a little of my drunkenness, I am so much in league with them that I count the very same person both enemy and friend. And even now, no less, I will put forward the dreamer as an object of hatred, since they too did so, and I will detest him. And no one of sound mind would blame me for this, since I always yield to the opinions and votes of the majority. But when he changes to a better life, and no longer dreams nor suffers, dragged down by the empty fantasies of those who are empty of true glory, into the mire, nor pictures night and darkness and chance encounters with obscure and inscrutable events, but rising up out of deep sleep continues wakeful, and welcomes clarity in place of obscurity, and truth in place of false supposition, and day in place of night, and light in place of darkness, and turns away from the wife of the Egyptian, bodily pleasure, who urges him to come into her and enjoy her company, because of his longing for self-mastery and his unspeakable zeal for piety, and lays claim again to the portion of goods, kindred, and ancestral, from which he had seemed estranged, deeming it right to recover for himself the share of virtue that belongs to him, and, advancing by small increments of improvement, comes at last to be established as at the summit and end of his own life and declares aloud, having learned by precise experience that he belongs to God, Gen 50:19, and no longer at all to anything perceptible that belongs to created being, then his brothers will make reconciling compacts with him, turning their hatred into friendship and their ill will into goodwill, while I, a follower of these men, for I have learned, as a servant, to obey as masters, will not cease praising him for his change of heart. Since even Moses, the Hierophant, rescues from destruction, as a thing worthy of love and worthy of remembrance, his change of heart, by means of the symbol of the bones, which he did not think it right to allow to remain buried forever in Egypt, Exod 13:19, holding it a most grievous thing that, if anything good had blossomed in the soul, this should be allowed to wither and be drowned and vanish beneath the floods which the Egyptian river of the passions, the body, pours forth continually through all the senses. The vision, then, that appeared concerning the sheaves has been discussed, and its interpretation in terms of Earth. It is now time to examine the other vision, and how it is distinguished by the art of dream interpretation. He saw, it says, another dream and related it to his father and his brothers and said, Behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. And his father rebuked him and said, What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall we indeed come, I and your mother and your brothers, to bow down to you upon the earth? And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. Gen 37:9-11. The students of the heavens, then, say that the zodiacal circle, being the greatest of the circles in heaven, has been set with stars in 12 signs, from which it also took its name, and that the sun and moon, ever revolving about it, pass through each of the signs, not at equal speed, but in unequal numbers and times, the sun in 30 days, the moon in about a 12th part of this, which comes to 2.5 days. It seemed, then, that the one who saw this God-sent vision was being worshipped by 11 stars, ranking himself as the 12th to complete the circle of the zodiac. I recall also having heard before from a certain man who approached the subject neither carelessly nor casually, that it is not only human beings who are mad for glory, but the stars too, contending for first place. Judge it right that the greater should always be attended by the lesser as their guard of honor. These matters, then, whether they have any truth or are mere idle talk, must be left for the sky hunters to examine. But we say this, that the lover of undiscerning eagerness and irrational contentiousness and empty glory, ever puffed up by folly, thinks it right to look down not only upon human beings, but upon the very nature of existing things. And he supposes that all things have come to be for his own sake, and that each thing must bring him tribute as though to a king, earth, water, air, heaven, and he indulges in such an excess of foolishness that he cannot reckon what even a witless child would understand. That no craftsman ever makes the whole for the sake of a part, but makes a part for the sake of the whole. And man is a part of the whole universe, so that, having come into being for the completion of the world, he would rightly himself contribute to it in turn. But some are so full of such nonsense that they grow indignant if the world does not follow their wishes. For this reason Xerxes, king of the Persians, wishing to strike terror into his enemies, made a display of grandiose deeds, innovating upon nature itself. For he transformed earth and sea, giving continent in exchange for sea and sea in exchange for continent, yoking the Hellespont with bridges, and breaking open Mount Athos into deep gulfs which, filled with sea, at once became a new handmade ocean, nature's ancient order utterly changed. And having, as it seemed, worked wonders upon the regions of earth, he went up, in his audacious schemes, drawing impiety along with himself even into heaven, wretched man, as though he would move the immovable and overthrow the divine host. And, as the saying goes, he began from the sacred things themselves. For he shot arrows at the noblest of the heavenly bodies, the sun, the leader of the day, as though he himself were not being wounded by the invisible arrow of madness, not only through his desire for the impossible, but also through his desire for the most unholy deeds, either one of which alone would bring great disgrace on anyone who attempted it. There is a story that the most populous tribe of the Germans, among whom the sea ebbs and flows, at the incoming tides rush forward eagerly, brandishing their swords bared, and run to meet the surging sea as though it were a mass of enemy troops. It is right to hate them for this, that out of godlessness they dare to take up arms against parts of nature that cannot be enslaved, and right to mock them, because they attempt the impossible as though it were possible, supposing that water, like a living creature, can be stabbed, wounded, killed, and again can feel pain, feel fear, flee in terror before an attacker, and undergo all the other passions of the soul, both pleasures and pains. Only yesterday, so to speak, I knew a man among the governors who, when he held the administration and oversight of Egypt, resolved to disturb our ancestral customs, and in particular to abolish the most sacred and awe-inspiring law concerning the seventh day, and tried to force people to work on it and to do other things contrary to established custom, thinking this would be the beginning of a wider transgression of all our other customs, if he could succeed in doing away with our ancestral observance of the seventh day. And when he saw that those he was coercing would not yield to his commands, and that the rest of the populace was far from calm, but bore the matter bitterly and harshly, mourning and downcast, as though over the enslavement, sacking, and razing of their homeland, he thought fit to argue them into lawbreaking, saying, "If an enemy attack should suddenly occur, or a flood should come when the river's flow bursts through the embankments in its rising, or a rush of fire, or a bolt of lightning, or famine, or plague, or earthquake, or any other evil, whether man-made or sent by heaven, will you spend the day quietly at home? Or will you go out in your customary posture, drawing your right hand in beneath your garment and tucking the other hand under your cloak at your side, so that not even against your will you might do anything toward saving yourselves? And will you sit in your little synagogues, gathering your usual assembly, safely reading your sacred books, and expounding whatever is not clear, and lingering at leisure over your ancestral philosophy through long discourses? No, shake off all this, and raise a cry on behalf of your own bodies and those of your parents, children, and other dearest kin, and if the truth must be told, for your possessions and property too, so that not even these may be destroyed. Strip off your reverence for the divine. And this very man," he said, "I myself am all the things I have named, hurricane, war, flood, thunderbolt, famine, and plague, the earthquake that shakes and stirs up what stands firmly fixed. I am not the mere name of fated necessity, but a visible power standing near at hand. What then shall we say of a man who says or thinks such things, merely that he is out of place? Is he not rather some strange new evil from beyond the ocean, or from between the worlds, since a man weighed down by every misfortune has dared to liken himself to the one who is blessed in every way? This man would go so far as to blaspheme the sun, the moon, and the other stars, whenever something hoped for in its proper season fails to occur at all, or occurs only with difficulty. A scorching heat in summer, or a harsh cold descending in winter, or a spring in autumn, the one barren of good crops, the other all too fruitful in breeding sickness. So, letting out every rope of an unbridled mouth and a slanderous tongue, he will accuse the stars as though they had failed to pay their accustomed tribute, all but demanding that earthly things be honored and worshipped by the heavenly ones, and himself most of all, inasmuch as, being a man, he is thought to surpass the other living creatures. Such, then, are the ringleaders enrolled among us in the service of empty opinion. Let us now look in turn at the members of their chorus. These are forever plotting against those who practice virtue. Whenever they see such people eager to brighten their lives with undeceiving truth, and to shine as if by the pure light of moon or sun, they hinder them, whether by deceit or by force, driving them into the sunless region of the impious, which deep night holds fast, and endless darkness, and countless throngs of idols, phantoms, and dreams. And having plunged them down there, they force them to worship these as masters. For we take the one who practices wisdom to be the sun, since as the sun gives light to bodies, this man gives light to the affairs of the soul. And we take the education he employs to be the moon. For it is at night that the use of each is purest and most beneficial. And we take as brothers the refined reasonings born of education and of a soul in training, all of them guiding life along a straight path. But those who have resolved to say and think nothing sound think it right to seize these by the neck with manifold and cunning wrestling holds, to throw them and break their necks, and to trip them and dash them down. And this is why the father, not Jacob, but right reason, which is older even than he, gently rebukes such a man, saying, "What is this dream you have dreamed?" Gen 37:10. Did you not see a mere dream? Or did you suppose that things free by nature would, by human compulsion, become slaves, and that the ruling powers would become subject, and, more paradoxical still, subject not to others but to those they rule, enslaved not to other things but to the things enslaved to them? Unless, that is, by the power of God, who alone can do all things, for whom it is lawful both to move what is immovable and to fix in place what is carried along, a reversal of the established order into its opposite should come to be. For what reason could there be for being angry at, and rebuking, one who has merely seen a vision in sleep? "Did I see it willingly?" he will say. "Why do you bring against me the charges due to those who have done wrong deliberately? I have simply recounted what fell upon me from outside and struck my mind suddenly against my will. But in truth, the present discussion is not about a dream at all, but about things that resemble dreams, things which seem, to those not fully purified, to be great, splendid, and worth fighting for, but which, in the eyes of the incorruptible judges of truth, are small, dim, and deserving only of mockery. Shall I then, he says, I write reason, come, and shall the soul of the company of learning also arrive, mother and nurse together, education flourishing in virtue, and shall the offspring of us both also hasten to join us? And standing opposite in this way, arranged in order, shall we raise our hands in due arrangement and pray, having first put away all vanity. Then shall we cast ourselves down to the ground, beseeching and attempting to prostrate ourselves. But may the sun never shine upon such doings, since deep darkness suits evil, and far-reaching light suits the good. What greater evil could there be than for counterfeit and deceptive vanity to be praised and admired in place of unfeigned and truthful freedom from vanity? It is beautifully distinguished, the statement that the Father kept the matter in mind. Gen 37:11. For it is the work not of a barren and sterile soul, but of one truly mature and capable of bringing forth, to live in continual watchfulness and to despise nothing at all, but to stand in awe before the inescapable and invincible power of God, and to look about on every side, wondering what the outcome will finally be for it. This is also why the oracles say that the sister of Moses, whom we who read allegorically call Hope, watched from a distance, Exod 2:4, looking, no doubt, toward the end of life, so that a favorable outcome might meet her, sent down from above, from heaven, by the one who brings all things to fulfillment. For many, often, after crossing unsailable seas and being carried safely and without danger on a long voyage by favorable winds, have suddenly been shipwrecked in the very harbors, just as they were about to make land. And countless others, after winning heavy wars that lasted many years by main force and coming through unwounded, without even the surface of their skin being grazed, and returning as though from a great public festival and a civic celebration, whole and entire, have come back with cheerful high spirits into their own homes, only to be treacherously attacked there, of all places, where it was least to be expected, and slaughtered, as the saying goes, like oxen at the manger. Just as these unexpected and unpredictable misfortunes tend to fall upon us, so too they thrust back the powers of the soul toward their opposites and force them to reverse course, if they can, and try to overturn them. For who, entering the bitter contest of life, has remained unfallen? Who has not been tripped up? Happy is the one it does not happen to often. On whom has fortune not lain in wait, drawing breath and gathering strength, so that once she has grappled with him, she may snatch him away at once, before her opponent even has time to dust himself for the wrestling? Do we not already know of some who have come from childhood to old age without perceiving any disturbance at all, whether through the good fortune of their nature, or through the diligence of those who reared and educated them, or through both together, and who have been filled with a deep peace within themselves? The peace that is peace in truth, the archetype of the peace found in cities, and who for this reason have been thought fortunate, because they never perceived, even in a dream, the civil war kindled by the passions. The most grievous of all wars, only then, in the very sunset of their life, to run aground and be shipwrecked, either through an unbridled tongue, or an insatiable belly, or an ungoverned lust of the parts below the belly. For some have set their heart on the threshold of old age, on the youthful life of the prodigal, dishonored, disowned, shameful, while others have set it on the life of the villain, the false accuser, the rogue, taking up love of mischief just when it would have been fitting to lay it down, old as it already was. For this reason, we must supplicate God and beseech him earnestly that our perishable race not be passed over, but that he command his saving mercy toward it to last forever. For it is hard, once we have tasted unmixed peace, to be kept from being sated with it. But come, is this evil, hunger, a lighter thing than thirst? It has love and longing to comfort it. But when, from another spring, one whose stream is murky and diseased, a man must, through desire to drink, be filled to the full, then of necessity, gorged with a bittersweet pleasure, he must live out an unlivable life, running after harmful things as though they were beneficial, in ignorance of what truly profits him. The most grievous onset of evils occurs among these, whenever the irrational powers of the soul, having set upon the powers of reason, overcome them. For as long as either herds of cattle obey their herdsmen, or flocks of sheep their shepherds, or flocks of goats their goatherds, the affairs of the herd go rightly. But whenever those set over them as herd leaders prove weaker than the beasts themselves, everything goes amiss, and disorder arises out of order, unruliness out of good discipline, turmoil out of stability, and confusion out of discernment, since no lawful authority any longer stands in place. For if it did, the trouble would already have been put down. What then? Do we not suppose that within ourselves too there is a herd of animals, insofar as the irrational multitude has been cut off from the soul, and that the mind, the ruling part, is the herd leader? So long as it is strong and capable of leading the herd, everything is accomplished rightly and to advantage. But whenever some weakness comes upon it, at its very foundation, the subject part too must of necessity suffer along with it. And precisely when it seems most to have been set free, then it becomes most ready as a prize lying open for whoever wishes merely to raise dust against it in the contest. For it is the nature of anarchy to be treacherous, and of rule to be a thing of safety, above all where law and justice are honored, and this is the rule that goes together with reason. Let this, then, be the precise account of the dreams of empty opinion. As for the forms belonging to gluttony, they are drink and food, though the one requires no great variety, while the other calls for countless seasonings and relishes. These, however, are laid upon two men charged with care for them, the concerns of elaborate drinking upon the chief cupbearer, and those of the more necessary eating upon the chief baker. And most exactly examined, they are brought forward as men who see their dreams pictured in a single night. For both press toward the same need, preparing food not simply, but food accompanied by pleasure and delight. And each toils over half of the matter of nourishment, but together the two of them cover the whole. And moreover, each part is drawn along by the other. Those who have eaten immediately reach for drink, and those who have drunk immediately for food, so that it is not least for this reason, too, that the same span of time has been recorded for the appearance of both their visions. The chief cupbearer, then, was allotted drunkenness with wine, and the chief baker gluttony. And each sees in his vision the things proper to himself, the one, wine and the plant that produces wine, the vine, the other, loaves set out upon baskets, thoroughly cleansed and himself carrying the baskets on his head, Gen 40, 16-17. It would be fitting to examine the earlier dream first, and it runs as follows. In my sleep there was a vine before me, and in the vine were three roots, and it was flourishing, having brought forth shoots, the clusters of grapes were ripe. And Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the cluster and pressed it out into the cup, and gave the cup into Pharaoh's hands. Gen 40, 9-11. How wonderfully and how truly he spoke in advance in saying in my sleep. For in truth, one who pursues drunkenness not so much from wine as from folly, being vexed by uprightness and wakefulness, has, like those who are asleep, been cast down and let go slack, and has shut the eyes of his soul, being able neither to see nor to hear anything worth seeing or hearing. Overcome, he travels through life not by a road, but by a blind and unguided pathless waste, impaled on thorns and thistles, and sometimes even rolling down precipices and falling upon others, so that he pitifully destroys both them and himself. The deep and prolonged sleep, by which every base person is possessed, takes away true perceptions and fills the mind with false images and unstable phantasms, persuading it to accept blameworthy things as praiseworthy. For indeed such a man now dreams of grief as though it were joy, and does not perceive that what belongs to folly and to raving madness. He sees the plant, the vine. There was, he says, a vine before me, Gen 40, 9, the thing desired before the one desiring it, vice before the one given over to vice. A vine which we, unthinking, without realizing it, cultivate against ourselves, whose fruit we both eat and drink, assigning it to each kind of nourishment, and of which, as it seems, we lay claim not to half the harm, but to the whole and entire and complete measure of it. It is fitting not to be ignorant that the intoxicating fruit of the vine affects all who make use of it not alike, but often in opposite ways, so that some are found better than themselves through it, and others worse. For in some it relaxes the gloom and sullenness, loosens their anxieties, softens their fits of anger and grief, trains their characters toward gentleness, and makes their souls gracious to themselves. But in others, on the contrary, it inflames their tempers, tightens their pains, stirs up their lusts, and rouses their boorishness, producing a mouth unbarred and a tongue unbridled, senses without a door, passions grown rabid and savage, and a mind startled and fluttering at everything. So that the condition of the former seems to resemble either windless clear air, or a calm, waveless sea, or the most peaceful stability found in cities, while that of the latter resembles either a violent and straining wind, or a stormy and wave-tossed deep, or civil strife. A turmoil more ill-named even than a war fought without truce and without herald. Of two banquets, then, the one is filled with laughter, play, promises, hopes of good things, acts of favor, good cheer, fair speech, gladness, delight, and freedom from fear. While the other is filled with gloom, dejection, collisions, insults, wounds, men snarling, glowering, barking, throttling, wrestling each other down with all their might, mutilating ears and noses, and whatever part of the body happens to be at hand, men displaying the drunkenness and riotous excess of an entire life, in an unholy contest accompanied by every kind of disgraceful conduct. It would follow, then, to reckon that the vine too is a symbol of two things, folly and gladness. Each of these, though it could be shown from many examples, we shall demonstrate briefly, through a few, so as not to speak at length. Next, just as the sun distinguishes day from night, so Moses says that God built a partition between light and darkness. For God separated the light from the darkness. Gen 1:4. And in another sense, just as the sun when it rises reveals the hidden shapes of bodies, so God, having generated all things, not only brought them into visibility, but made things that previously did not exist at all, being not merely a craftsman but a creator. The sacred word speaks of sun in many senses, according to hidden meanings. In one sense, it means the human mind, which those who are compelled to serve what is generated rather than the ungenerated build up and equip like a city those of whom it is said that they built strong cities for Pharaoh. Pithom, reason, to which persuasion belongs, and Ramesses, sense perception, by which the soul is eaten away as though by moths, for Ramesses is interpreted the gnawing of a moth. And on, Exod. 1:11, the mind, which he named the city of the sun, since like the sun it holds the sovereignty over our whole mass and extends its own powers into the whole like rays. The priest and attendant of the mind is entitled father-in-law by everyone who has bound himself to the citizenship of the body. His name is Joseph. For he gave him, it says, Asenet, daughter of Potipharah, priest of the city of the sun, as wife. Gen 41:45. In a second sense, he calls sense perception symbolically the sun, since all sensible things are made visible by the intellect. Of this he has spoken thus. The sun rose upon him when the form of God had passed by. Gen 32:31. For indeed, whenever we can no longer occupy ourselves with the most sacred ideas and the incorporeal images of being, but turn elsewhere and pass on, we make use of another light, the light of sense perception, which differs not at all plainly from darkness in comparison with sound reason. This light, once risen, woke sight and hearing, and taste and smell and touch as well as though from sleep, but turned prudence and justice and knowledge and wisdom, though wide awake, to sleep. For this reason, the sacred word says that no one can be pure before evening. Lev 11:24 and elsewhere, since the intellect is still overpowered by the movements that come by way of sense perception, as by poisons. And he lays down for the priests, in the same breath, both an inescapable law and a maxim when he says, he shall not eat of the holy things unless he has washed his body with water, and the sun has gone down, and he has become clean. Lev 22:6-7. For through these words, he makes it very clear that no one is wholly pure, so as to make use of the holy and sacred rites, for whom it still happens that he honors the sensible splendors of mortal life. But if someone does not accept these, he is, correspondingly, illumined by the light of prudence, by which he will be able to wash and cleanse away the stains of empty opinions. Or do you not see that the sun itself produces opposite effects both when it rises and when it sets? For when it rises, all things on earth are lit up all around, while the things in heaven are hidden. But when it sets, conversely, the stars shine forth while the things around the earth are darkened. In the same way within us too. When the light of the senses rises like a sun, the truly Olympian and heavenly sciences happen to be hidden. But when it sets, the most starlike and most divine rays of the virtues appear, at which time the pure mind comes to be, hidden by no sensible thing. In a third sense, he calls the divine word, sun, the model of the sun that circles through heaven, as was said before, of which it is said. The sun went forth over the earth, and Lot entered into Zoar, and the Lord rained upon Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire. Gen 19:23-24. For the word of God, when it arrives at our earthly constitution, comes to the aid and assistance of those who are akin to virtue and inclined toward it, so as to provide them a complete refuge and salvation, but sends upon their adversaries ruin and incurable destruction. In a fourth sense, Son refers to the ruler of the universe himself, as I have already said, through whom the incurable of our sins, though they seem to be hidden in shadow, are uncovered. For all things are as knowable to God as they are possible for him. Hence he leads, to be exposed before the Son, those whose vigor of soul has been broken down, who consort licentiously and lustfully with the daughters of the mind, the senses, as though with streetwalkers and prostitutes. For it says, "And the people settled in Shittim," which is interpreted thorns, a symbol of the passions that prick and wound the soul, and it was profaned, it says, by fornicating with the daughters of Moab. These are the senses called daughters of the mind, for Moab is interpreted from the father, and he adds, "Take all the leaders of the people and make an example of them before the Lord, opposite the sun, and the wrath of the Lord will turn away from Israel." Num 25:1-4. For not only, wishing hidden wrongdoings to become manifest, did he shine upon them with the sun's rays, but through symbols he also called the Father of the universe Son, to whom all things are plain, even whatever is accomplished invisibly in the recesses of the mind. And once they have become manifest, he says that the only merciful one will be merciful. Why? Because, if the intellect, supposing that it will escape the notice of the divine as it does wrong, as though God were not able to see all things, goes astray secretly and in hidden places, and afterward, whether of itself or because someone has guided it, comes to understand that it is impossible for anything to be unknown to God, and lays itself and all its own deeds open, and bringing them out into the open displays them, as though into the light of the sun, to the overseer of the universe, saying that it repents of the things it formerly judged wrongly through an ungrateful disposition, for nothing is unknown to him. But all things are known and plain, not only what has been done, but even what is hoped for. In great abundance then it has been purified and helped, and it has tamed the reproof that stood over it as chastiser, since that reproof employs a just anger, if it accepts repentance as a younger brother of never sinning at all. He appears, indeed, elsewhere too, to take up the sun symbolically for the cause, as in the law written concerning those who lend on pledges. Let us cite the law. If you take in pledge your neighbor's garment, you shall return it to him before the sun sets. For this alone is his covering, this is the garment of his shame. In what shall he sleep? So if he cries out to me, I will listen to him, for I am merciful. Exod 22:26-27. Is it not fitting that those who think the lawgiver has such great concern about a cloak, even if not to reproach them, at least to remind them, should be asked, "What are you saying, noble sirs? Does the creator and ruler of the universe call himself merciful over so trifling a matter as a garment not returned by a debtor to a creditor?" This is what it means to suppose such things, and to attribute human pettiness to the ungenerated, incorruptible nature, full of blessedness and happiness, contrary to what is right, and just all because one has not once beheld the greatness of the virtue of the God who is great in all things. For what wrong do creditors do in holding the pledges taken by them, until they recover what is their own? The debtors are poor, someone will perhaps say, and deserve pity. Then would it not have been better to write a law by which they would rather raise a collection for them than declare them debtors, or forbid lending on pledges altogether? But he who permits it would not reasonably be indignant, as though they were acting impiously, at those who do not release beforehand the things they have received. But a man who has come to such an extremity of poverty, so to speak, and wears a single rag, brings in new creditors the venom cast at him by onlookers who set aside pity, which lies open before those who suffer such misfortunes, in the home, at the temples, in the marketplace, and everywhere. But as it is, even the one covering he had for shame, with which he concealed the secret parts of his nature, this he brought and held out. A pledge for what, tell me? For some better garment. For no one lacks necessary food, so long as springs well up, rivers in flood overflow, and the earth yields its yearly fruits. So then, is the creditor either exceedingly rich or exceedingly cruel, that he should be willing to lend someone 4 drachmas, or perhaps even less, rather than lend to so poor a man, or rather give it to him outright, or that he should take as a pledge the 1 garment that man had, which by another name could rightly be called stripping a man of his cloak? For it is the custom of cloak strippers, when they undress people, to take away their clothing and leave those who had it naked. But why did he take care that no one should sleep unclothed at night, while he was no longer equally concerned that one who is awake by day should be shamefully naked? Or is it not that at night and in darkness all things are hidden, so that one feels shame less or not at all, while by day and in light they are uncovered, so that one is compelled to blush the more? But why did he command not to give the garment, but to return it? For a return is made of what belongs to another, and pledges belong more to the lenders than to the borrowers. But do you not consider this, that he did not command the debtor, once he had received the garment as bedding, to remove it upon rising the next day and carry it back to the creditor? But the eunuch, who is also Pharaoh's chief cupbearer, having pictured to himself in fantasy the vine, that plant which begets folly, adds to his portrait 3 roots, so as to signify the furthest extremities of wrongdoing according to the 3 times, for the root is the furthest point. So when folly overshadows the whole soul and takes possession of it, leaving no part of it free or unbound, it compels the soul to commit not only those sins that are curable, but also those that are incurable. The sins that admit of treatment, then, are written first, and are the easiest, while the incurable ones, being extremely difficult, are written last, corresponding to the roots. And just as, I think, prudence begins by benefiting us in small matters and ends in the greatest achievements of right action, in the same way folly too, forcing the soul from above and gradually separating it from instruction, banishes it far from right reason and drags it down even to the furthest extremities. The dream showed that after the roots the vine flowered, put forth shoots, and bore fruit, for it, he says, was flourishing, having brought forth shoots, the clusters of grapes were ripe. Gen 40:10, a vine that I wish had instead remained fruitless, never put forth green growth, and withered away entirely for all time. For what greater evil could there be than folly flourishing and bearing abundant fruit? But also the cup of Pharaoh, the reservoir of senselessness, drunken excess, and unceasing intoxication throughout one's whole life, is in my hand, he says, Gen 40:11, which is equivalent to saying it lies within my own undertakings, designs, and powers, for the passion will not prosper of its own accord, apart from my own contrivances. For just as it is fitting that the reins be in the hands of the charioteer, and the rudder in the hands of the helmsman, since only in this way is the chariot's course, and the ship's voyage successfully accomplished, so too the fulfillment of the intemperate man's craving lies in the hand and power of the one who practices the other kind of gluttony, namely drunkenness. But what happened to him, that he endured boasting of denial rather than confession, in a matter deserving confession? Or would it not have been better not to refuse to acknowledge that he is a teacher of incontinence, than to heap up for the incontinent man the kindling of his passion, as though he were the inventor and craftsman of a shattered and broken, most shameful life? It is something like this. Folly prides itself on things it would be reasonable to hide. As it stands, he glories not only in carrying about in his hands and displaying to everyone the cup, the reservoir of the unrestrained soul, but also in pressing the grape into it, that is, in fashioning the very thing that fulfills the passion and bringing what was hidden out into the light. For just as infants, longing for nourishment, when about to draw milk, press and squeeze the breast of their nurse, so too the craftsman of incontinence forcefully presses the spring from which the evil of drunkenness pours forth, so that he may make use of the pressed out drops as the sweetest nourishment. Let this, then, be our portrait of the man made drunk with strong wine, a drunken, raving evil, and incurable. Now we must in turn examine his kinsman, the glutton, likewise a companion of gorging and voracity, who practices his craft intemperately in matters of eating. And yet not much effort is needed to hunt him down, for the dream that appeared is a most faithful impression of his likeness. So if we examine it carefully, we shall behold him as a reflection in a mirror. I thought, he says, that I was carrying 3 baskets of fine bread on my head, Gen 40, 16. Now, interpreting allegorically, we say that the head is the ruling mind of the soul, and that everything rests upon it. Indeed, he once cried out concerning it, "All these things have come upon me." Gen 42:36. So, having arranged a procession of the things he has devised against his wretched belly, he displays it. And the fool, carrying his baskets, feels no shame at being weighed down by so heavy a threefold burden of baskets, which is to say, by the three divisions of time. For the devotees of pleasure say that it is composed of the memory of past delights, the enjoyment of present ones, and the hope of those to come. So the three baskets correspond to the three divisions of time, and the pastries in the baskets correspond to what fits each division: memories for the past, participation for the present, expectations for the future. While the one who bears all this for the pleasure lover has filled a table that knows no truce and lacks the salt of friendship, drawing not from one kind of intemperance, but from nearly every species and kind of licentiousness. Of this table Pharaoh the king alone partakes, as though at a public feast, since he has cultivated the scattering, dispersal, and destruction of self-restraint. For Pharaoh is interpreted as scattering. His grandeur and kingliness consist not in glorying, as would be fitting, over the goods of self-control, but in priding himself on the practices of disgusting excess that are unfitting to boast of, a man who has run aground on insatiability, gluttony, and soft living. Therefore the birds, that is, the unforeseeable chances that fly in from outside, will sweep over everything like fire, set it ablaze, and consume it with their all-devouring power. Gen 40:17, so that not even a remnant is left for enjoyment to the basket bearer, who had hoped to carry his inventions and contrivances secure and unassailable for all time. Thanks be to the victorious God, who renders futile the efforts brought to their utmost pitch by the lover of passion, sending winged creatures invisibly to destroy and ruin them. So the mind, stripped of what it had fashioned, will be found headless and dead, as though its neck had been cut off, nailed fast, like those impaled, to the stake of helpless and destitute lack of instruction. For as long as none of those sudden, unforeseeable visitations does any damage, the arts devoted to the enjoyment of pleasure seem to prosper. But when they strike unseen, those arts are overturned, and their craftsman is destroyed along with them. So much, then, for the dreams that have revealed the workshop of taste divided between the two forms of nourishment, drink and food, not the necessary kind, but the superfluous and unrestrained kind. Next in order, we must at once investigate the dreams of the one who seems to reign over these and all the other faculties of the soul, whose name is Pharaoh. "In my sleep," he says, "I thought I was standing by the bank of the river, and behold, seven cows came up out of the river, choice in flesh and beautiful in form, and they grazed in the marsh grass. And behold, seven other cows came up out of the river after them, evil and ugly in form and thin in flesh, the like of which I had never seen, so ugly in all the land of Egypt. And the thin, ugly cows ate up the seven first, beautiful and choice cows, and went into their bellies. And it was not evident that they had gone into their bellies, and their appearance was as ugly as at the beginning. Then I awoke and fell asleep again, and I saw once more in my sleep. Seven ears of grain came up on one stalk, full and good, and seven other ears, thin and blighted by the wind, sprouted after them. And the seven thin ears swallowed up the good and full ears." Gen 41:1-24. You see then the prelude of the self-lover, who, though shifting, turning, and changeable in both body and soul, says, "I thought I was standing, and did not reckon that steadfastness and stability belong properly to God alone, and to anyone who is God's friend." You see the prelude of self-love, which, being mutable and shifting and changeable in both body and soul, says, "I thought I was standing, not reckoning that steadfastness and fixity belong to God alone, and to whoever is his friend." The clearest proof of the steadfast power that surrounds him is this world, which is always in the same condition and in the same way, for if the world is inclined to neither side, how is its craftsman not steadfast? And then, further, the most truthful witnesses, the sacred oracles. For it is said in the person of God, "Here I stand there before you on the rock at Horeb," Exodus 17:6, equivalent to, "I, the one who appears, being here, am also there, and everywhere, having filled all things, standing in the same state and remaining, being unchangeable, before you or anything that exists came into being, established upon the highest and most ancient power and source, from which the coming into being of things that exist rained down and the stream of wisdom overflowed. For I am he who brought forth a spring of water from the flinty rock, Deuteronomy 8:15, as it is said elsewhere. And Moses too testifies concerning the unchangeableness of the divine, saying, I saw the place where the God of Israel stood, Exodus 24:10, hinting at the immutability of the divine through this standing and establishment. But so great is the excess of steadfastness that belongs to the divine, that it imparts stability, as the best of possessions, even to the natures it has selected. At once, for instance, he says his covenant, full of graces, and this covenant is the law and the most ancient reason of all things that exist, will be established firmly, as upon a foundation, in the soul of the righteous, like a godlike image, when he says to Noah, I will establish my covenant with you. Genesis 9:11. And he intimates two further things besides. First, that righteousness is inseparable from God's covenant. And second, that whereas others bestow gifts that differ from those who receive them, God bestows not only these gifts but the very recipients to themselves, for he has given me to myself, and each of the things that exist to itself. For I will establish my covenant with you is equivalent to I will give you as a gift to yourself. And all who love God are eager to flee the storm of restless meddling, in which surge and swell are forever churning, and to find harbor in the calm and most sheltering havens of virtue. Do you not see what is said of the wise Abraham, that he was standing before the Lord? Genesis 8:22. For when could a mind reasonably be able to stand, unless it is no longer swaying as on a balance scale, once it stands directly opposite God, both seeing and being seen? For its steadfastness comes from two sources, from seeing the one beyond compare, in that it is not dragged this way, and that by things resembling one another, and from being seen, in that its guide has judged it worthy that his own vision should come to the best part of itself. And to Moses too an oracle of this kind was given. Stand here with me, Deuteronomy 5:31, through which both things spoken of are made plain, both that the virtuous person does not sway, and the steadfastness of the one who is, in respect to all things. For indeed what draws near to God is made kin to him through its unchangeable self-standing. And the mind, once it has come to rest, clearly recognized what a great good stillness is, and, marveling at its beauty, understood that it belongs either to God alone or to the nature situated between the mortal and the immortal kind. At any rate, he says, And I stood between the Lord and you, Deuteronomy 5:5, not meaning by this that he was fixed upon his own feet, but wishing to show this, that the mind of the wise, freed from storms and wars, and enjoying windless calm and deep peace, is greater than a human being, yet less than God. For the common, herd-like human mind is shaken and stirred up by whatever chance befalls it, while the blessed and happy mind has no share in evils. But the virtuous mind occupies the middle ground, so as to be, properly speaking, neither God himself nor a human being, but touching both extremes by its humanity belonging to a mortal race, and by its virtue to an imperishable one. Something very similar to this is the oracle given concerning the high priest. Whenever, it says, he enters the Holy of Holies, he shall not be a human being until he comes out, Leviticus 16:17. And if he does not then become a human being, clearly he does not become God either, but a minister of God, belonging by his mortal part to becoming, and by his immortal part made kin to the unbegotten. He has been allotted the middle rank, until he goes out again to what belongs to his body and flesh. And this is its nature. Whenever the mind, seized by divine love, straining itself all the way to the inmost shrine, advances with every impulse and eagerness, being possessed by God, it forgets all other things, forgets itself too, and remembers only him to whom it is attached and devoted and whom it serves, to whom, consecrating them, it offers up as incense its sacred and untouchable virtues. But when it comes to a stop and the great longing relaxes, it runs back from the divine and becomes human again, meeting the human concerns that had been lying in wait in the outer courts, so that, the moment it peers out from within, they may seize upon it. So then Moses records the perfect person as neither God nor human, but as I said, on the border between the unbegotten and the perishable nature. while the one who is progressing he places again in the middle region, between the living and the dead, calling those who share their life with wisdom the living, and those who delight in folly the dead. For it is said of Aaron that he stood between the dead and the living, and the plague was checked. Numbers 16:48. For he examines the life of virtue neither among the dead, having longing and zeal for the good, nor among those who live in the utmost and perfect happiness, for something is still lacking with respect to the goal, but he touches upon both. And it is said properly that the plague was checked, not that it ceased. For in the case of the perfect, the things that shatter and crush and break the soul cease altogether, but in the case of those making progress they are diminished, being merely held back and restrained. Since then, standing and establishment and abiding forever in the same state, in unchangeableness and immutability, belong first to the one who is, and next to the reason of the one who is, which he called a covenant, and third to the wise person, and fourth to the one making progress what has happened to the base mind, liable to every curse, that it supposed it alone could stand, though it is carried along, as in a flood, and swept away by the successive eddies of things flowing in through the corpse-bearing body. For it says, I thought I was standing on the bank of the river. Genesis 40:1-17. We say that speech is symbolically a river, since each of the two is carried outward, and flowing, moves with unremitting speed, and at one time overflows abundantly the one with a flood of water, the other with a flood of words and names, and at another time falls short, slackening and subsiding. And each is beneficial, the one watering the fields, the other the souls of those eager to listen, and there are times when each does harm by swelling up the one by flooding the neighboring land, the other by stirring up and confounding the reasoning of those who do not attend to it. This, then, is likened to a river. But the nature of speech is twofold, the one better, the other worse, the better being that which benefits, the worse, necessarily, that which harms. And Moses set forth examples of each most clearly for those able to see. A river, he says, goes forth out of Eden to water the paradise. From there it is divided into four sources, Genesis 2:10. He calls the wisdom of the one who is Eden, which is interpreted as delight, because I think both the wisdom of God is a delight and God is the delight of wisdom, since it is also sung in the hymns. Delight yourself in the Lord, Psalm 37:4. And as though from a spring of wisdom, the divine reason descends like a river, to water and irrigate the Olympian and heavenly shoots and plants of virtue-loving souls, as though they were a paradise. And this sacred reason is divided into four sources, I mean, it is split into the four virtues, each of which is a queen. For to be divided into sources is not like territorial boundaries, but resembles kingship, so that, by displaying the virtues, it may at once declare the one who employs them a wise king, appointed not by human beings, but by the truthful and incorruptible and only free nature. For those who beheld Abraham's nobility say to him, You are a king from God among us. Genesis 23:6, laying down as a doctrine for those occupied with philosophy that the wise alone is ruler and king, and that virtue is a rule and kingship answerable to no one. A companion of Moses, likening this logos to a river, said in his hymns, The river of God was filled with water. Psalm 65, 964, 10 LXX. It is unreasonable to suppose that he is speaking literally of one of the streams that flow on earth. Rather, it seems, he is representing the divine logos as full of the stream of wisdom, having no part of itself empty and void, or rather, as he says, poured out whole through the whole and lifted to a height by the continuous and successive flow of that ever-running spring. There is another such song. The rush of the river gladdens the city of God. Psalm 46, 445, 5 LXX. What city? For the city now called holy, in which the sacred temple stands, is settled far from both sea and rivers, so it is clear that he wishes to point through hidden meanings to something other than the visible city. For in truth, the current of the divine logos, and, born continuously and in order with its rush, pours forth and gladdens all things through all things. For in one sense he calls the cosmos the city of God, since it received the whole bowl of the divine drink undiluted, and made radiant, obtained an unfading and everlasting share of gladness for all ages. And in another sense he means the soul of the wise person, in which God is said even to walk about as in a city. For he says, I will walk among you, and I will be your God. Leviticus 26:12. and to the soul of good fortune, when it holds out its own reasoning as the most sacred cup, who pours in the sacred ladles of gladness toward truth, if not the Logos, God's cupbearer and master of the feast, Leviticus 26:36. The Logos who is not distinct from the drink but is himself the undiluted wine, the radiance, the seasoning, the outpouring, the good cheer, the ambrosia of joy and gladness, to use poetic terms ourselves, the remedy. The city of God is called by the Hebrews Jerusalem, whose name, translated, is vision of peace. So do not seek the city of the existent one among the regions of earth, for it was not built of wood or stone, but in a soul free from war and keen-sighted, one that has set before itself as its goal the contemplative and peaceable life. For what house could one find among existing things more solemn and more holy for God than a mind that loves to behold, that is eager to see all things and does not desire, even in a dream, faction, or disturbance? Once again, the voice that is accustomed to converse with me invisibly and unseen whispers and says, O man, you seem to be ignorant of a great and much contested matter, which, ungrudgingly, for I have already taught you many other things in season, I will now teach you. Know then, noble one, that God alone is the most truthful peace, peace in the full sense, while all created and perishable being is unbroken war. For God acts by choice, but being is bound by necessity. So whoever has the strength to leave behind war and necessity and coming to be and perishing, and to desert to the unbegotten, to the imperishable, to the willed, to peace, might justly be said to be the dwelling place and city of God. Let it make no difference to you, then, whether you call the same underlying reality vision of peace or vision of God. For of the many named powers of the existent one, he is not merely an initiate but a leader of the mysteries of peace. Abraham, moreover, says that he will give the wise man an inheritance of land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, Genesis 15:18. Not so much a portion of territory as the better lot concerning ourselves. For our body, and the passions that arise in it and through it, is likened to the destiny of Egypt, while the soul and what is akin to it are likened to the Euphrates. He thereby sets down a doctrine most useful for life and most binding, that the person of worth has received as inheritance the soul and the virtues of the soul, just as, conversely, the base person has received the body and the vices of the body and those that come through the body. The word from signifies two things. One, that which is included together with that from which it is reckoned. The other, that which is apart from it. When we say that from morning to evening there are 12 hours, and from new moon to the 30th day 30 days, we reckon the first hour and the new moon together with the rest. But when someone says that a field is 3 or 4 stadia from the city, he clearly means apart from the city. So now too we must understand, from the river of Egypt, as meaning apart from that river. For he wishes, by removing us from bodily things, which are seen in a flux of corruption, both being corrupted and corrupting, that we should receive as inheritance the soul together with the incorruptible virtues worthy of incorruption. Thus, then, tracking the matter, we have found that the Logos is praiseworthy when likened to a river. But the Egyptian river itself, it turns out, was blameworthy, an untrained and ignorant thing, so to speak, a lifeless Logos. For this reason it also turns into blood, Exodus 7:20, being unable to nourish, for the Logos of lack of education gives no drink, and it breeds abundantly frogs, Exodus 8:6, bloodless and lifeless, that croak out a strange and harsh noise, a pain to the ear. It is said, too, that all the fish in it died, Exodus 7:21, fish which symbolically represent thoughts, for these swim and come to be in the Logos as in a river, resembling living creatures and giving it life. But in an uneducated Logos, the reflections of the mind have died, for nothing intelligent is to be found there, but only, as someone has said, disordered and unmeasured cawing sounds. Let this suffice on these matters. But since he confesses that he saw in a vision not only the standing and the river, but also the banks of the river, saying, I thought I was standing by the bank of the river, Genesis 41:17, it is necessary also to recall what is timely concerning the bank. Nature, then, appears to have fitted lips to living creatures, and especially to humans, for the sake of two most necessary things. One, silence, for the lips are a defense and a most secure barrier for the voice, the other, expression. For through them the stream of words is carried, since when the lips are closed, the stream is held back, but it is impossible for it to be carried unless they part. From this, nature trains and disciplines us for both speaking and keeping silence, as we watch for the fitting occasion of each. Is something worth hearing being said? Pay attention without opposing it in silence, according to the precept of Moses, be silent and listen, Deuteronomy 27:9. For of those who come to contentious disputes for the sake of rivalry, not one could rightly be considered either to speak or to listen, but for one intent on truth, beneficial. Again, when you see in the wars and evils of life the gracious hand of God and a power that stands over and shields you, be still, for this helper has no need of an ally. Of this too, there is a proof laid up in the sacred records. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall be silent. Exodus 14:14.